Hello, my friends. It's Friday, March 28th, 2025, and I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, your Red State refugee. And welcome to the Radical Russ Show, coming to you from Rolla J Studios in my undisclosed mountain hideaway in the beautiful state of Jefferson region of Southern Oregon. Welcome to the program. We got a lot of news to catch up for this end of week show. We're going to give you the latest updates on Signalgate or Whiskey Leaks, depending on which term you prefer. Turns out the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, has other massive security lapses we need to talk about, as well as some of the other principles from that Signal call. We'll get you all caught up with the latest news from Wired magazine and Der Spiegel in Germany. Also, great news coming out of the state of Maine, where the governor, Janet Mills, she stood up to Donald Trump and his bullying with respect to trans athletes in her state. She is still standing up to the anti-trans bullying, as well as a second judge in the federal courts. We'll get you caught up on that. We'll take a look at the Wisconsin Supreme Court race, which is now looking to top $100 million in political spending as billionaires Elon Musk and George Soros go at it, with a few other billionaires thrown in for fun like J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois. We'll take a look at how the Senate is working to make you spend more money, take more money out of your bank account for not having enough money in your bank account. Also, we go to the South American continent, the country of Brazil, where the former president there, Jair Bolsonaro, is facing trial over his attempted coup. Wait, that's an option? Then we've got a great interview coming to you for what would normally be our Boycott Idaho segment, but we're going to be visiting with my mentee, Sarah Frank, a woman I've known now for 15 years, who's doing the hard work of trying to change hearts and minds in Red State, Idaho. She's braver than I am, we'll tell you that much. Also, at the end of the program, time for my radical rant. We're going to take a look at the Democrats who approved the fascism that's ongoing in the United States of America. They can complain and cry about some of these people on the Signalgate leaks, but some of the Democrats approved these people. We'll give you the complete rundown, courtesy of trans activist Charlotte Clymer. But before we get to all of that, a few little odds and ends I wanted to mention. First of all, taking a look at the White House press pool, the latest addition this week to the White House press pool is podcaster Tim Pool. Now, if you don't know Tim Pool, he's this beanie wearing motherfucker who's totally alt-right, all in, red pilled on the whole magosphere. And it was revealed just recently that he had received millions in Russian money, had millions of dollars from Russian sources, and when confronted on it, was oblivious. Oh, gee, where did that money come from? I have no idea. It's just, as someone who does this podcasting as a hobby, it just blows my mind to know that guys like Charlie Kirk and Tim Pool are out there getting hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars from conservative think tanks, from Russians, from all sorts of nefarious sources. And yet those of us out here on the left that are trying to make a splash, boy, where are our billionaires? Where are our investments? The left really needs to do a better job at investing in the left-wing podosphere. And the thing is you got to throw money at it. The right didn't try to find a bunch of podcasters that they knew would be popular. They just started funneling money to every podcaster they could, and then the cream rises to the top, or I guess the scum rises to the top in their case. So come on, left-wing billionaires, let's get into this. Throw some money at us. Not necessarily, doesn't have to be me. I'm kind of semi-retired, but I wouldn't turn it down if it came my way. Also, one other little note I wanted to bring up from the hearings, the Senate hearings, with regard to the Signal scandal, the Whiskey Leaks. Of course, all of it was about the security lapse and the military action that took place there in Yemen. But there was one line of questioning I didn't want to let go by, and I'm glad that Mother Jones got a copy of this for us online. I'm just going to play the video for you that they put together. It's the independent senator of Maine, Angus King, questioning Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, about the annual threat assessment that is put out by the intelligence agencies to tell us what we need to fear, the terrorism, what sort of problems will occur for the military, what sort of scenarios must they plan for. And Angus King had a very pointed question for what was missing from that climate report.
Yeah, I've been on this committee now for, this is my 13th year. Every single one of these reports that we have had has mentioned global climate change as a significant national security threat, except this one. Has something happened? Has global climate change been solved? Why is that not in this report? And who made the decision that it should not be in the report when it's been in every one of the 11 prior reports?
I can't speak to the decisions made previously, but this annual threat assessment has been focused very directly on the threats that we deem most critical to the United States and our national security. Obviously, we're aware of occurrences within the environment and how they may impact operations, but we're focused on the direct threats to Americans' safety, well-being, and security.
How about how they will impact mass migration, famine, dislocation, political violence, which is the finding, by the way, of the 2019 annual threat assessment under the first Trump administration? You don't consider that a significant national security threat?
For the intelligence community, being aware of the environment that we're operating in is a given. What I focused this annual threat assessment on and the IC focused this threat assessment on are the most extreme and critical direct threats to our national security.
Let me ask a direct question. Who decided climate change should be left out of this report after it's been in the prior 11? Where was that decision
made? I gave direction to our team at ODNI to focus on the most extreme and critical national security threats that we face.
Your direction include no comments on climate change?
Senator, as I said, I focused on the most extreme and direct national
security threats.
That's not
a response to my question. Did you instruct that there be no finding in terms of climate change in this report?
I don't recall giving that instruction.
It just kind of mysteriously disappeared, you see. We told everyone they needed to focus on the most serious threats that our military might be facing. And for the past 11 years, we have found that climate change was a major threat. And so I directed my people to look at all what the major threats were, and somehow climate change isn't a major threat this time around, but nobody told them not to mention climate change. Get off it! Tulsi Gabbard is a liar. Of course they were directed not to say climate change. It's in Project 2025. We know that the Trump administration, their entire modus operandi here is don't measure it, don't talk about it, and then it doesn't exist. Climate change is, of course, a major operational threat to the U.S. military for those reasons that Senator King mentioned. Climate refugees, wildfires, floods, all the things that can happen that could be a problem for U.S. security. You think you got a problem at the border now? With people trying to get in now, wait until parts of Mexico and Latin America become uninhabitable due to high temperatures. Wait till the flooding starts and we start to have refugees coming in from those situations. Hell, talk about just domestic security situations as Florida starts to go underwater. I'm sure the Florida man, the many Florida mans out there, will respond to that in a perfectly balanced and rational way. No, this is about thwarting any mention of climate change. She couldn't even say the word climate in her answer. We have to be aware of the environment we're in. Yeah, the environment you're in is one where we just measured the global sea ice levels, and they are at the lowest levels ever recorded. There is less ice on planet Earth than scientists have ever recorded. This is going to have a major effect on our preparedness, major effect on our security. And as usual, see no evil, hear no evil in the Trump maladministration. The fallout from WikiLeaks continues. The story is gaining ground in the media. Even Republicans now are starting to turn. We got word that Senator Weicker of Mississippi is joining with Democrats in calling for investigations into this leak. Folks, when you've lost Senator Weicker from Mississippi, Oh boy, this thing is heating up. The Republicans in the administration continue to dissemble and deny that there was any sort of problem here, playing the game that, well, it's really no big deal because the mission was successful and nothing was leaked out to any of our enemies. So no harm, no foul. Never mind the fact that it was revealed within this Signal messaging that this is not the only time they've used Signal. They are apparently using Signal for other small group chats, as was directed in Project 2025, which suggested that they use Signal to avoid Freedom of Information Act requests and archiving of federal records that could be used later in, oh, I don't know, a trial at the Hague, perhaps, if it won't happen here in America. So that is, to me, a bigger part of the scandal than the fact that they accidentally invited on some reporter into the Signal chat. And thank God they did. And it wasn't Maggie Haberman or Bob Woodward saving it for a book 2 years from now so that we could find out right now that this is happening. How many other principals in the government are using these over-the-shelf apps to be able to communicate and avoid public records keeping? This is the biggest part of the scandal, as far as I'm concerned, is their sloppiness with the digital records and their desire to keep their activities hidden from the American people. And since the Signal story broke, other outlets have been digging into the digital archives of some of the principals on that call and found some shocking information. First, we have the German magazine Der Spiegel that went and took the names, Pete Hegseth and Marco Rubio and Tulsi Gabbard, all the people on the call, and started poking around in public databases. These, you've seen them online, the people search forms where you can spend like $50, $80, whatever, and find everything that's out there on the web on a particular person, you know, where they live, where they work, where they went to school, and so forth. So they did that with some of our top national security officials and found all sorts of names, phone numbers, emails, even passwords for some of our top security officials. Talk about a huge security lapse. These are supposed to be the people running our intelligence, and they can't even do basic operational security. We're clean on OPSEC. The hell you are. You've got phone numbers and emails all over the web. And then they went and looked in the dark web and found some even more compromising information. And I think the biggest note out of this story is the discovery that our Secretary of Defense, the DUI hire, Pete Hegseth, the former Fox News host, the guy with the white Christian nationalist tattoos, has a Russian email address. Hegseth@mail.ru. And Wired went and confirmed that the password for his Russian email account was the same password he was using for his domestic Gmail account. So they can confirm that, yeah, this is the same guy using the same account, unless two people randomly came up with the same password. And you know how you have a callback number, you know, when you sign into email or whatever, and if you've forgotten your password, there's a recovery phone number, you know, send me a text message to this number and then I can get into my account. The phone number that Pete Hegseth had for his recovery, for his Russian email, started with a +7 country code. What country is +7? That's right, you win, it's Russia. Our Secretary of Defense has a Russian email and a Russian phone number. That's what Der Spiegel found out. Wired went and found out some more information from the app Venmo. If you don't know, the app Venmo is one of those pay apps where, you know, you can put money into the account and then use Venmo online or with a little Venmo card or with a scanner. You can pay people and transfer money to other people. And you add little notes, you know, like, thanks for the dinner, Bob, or whatever, and you send them $20, right? So, a number of officials, including Susie Wiles, the White House Chief of Staff, Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor, Dan Katz, the Chief of Staff to the Secretary of Treasury, Joe Kent, the National Counterterrorism Director, Mike Needham, the Secretary of State's Chief of Staff, Marco Rubio's Chief of Staff, Brian McCormick from the National Security Council, and Morton Ortegas, who's a deputy for Steve Witkoff, the Ukraine envoy, you know, the one who was in Moscow, in the Kremlin at the time of the signal call. All of these people had their contacts in Venmo public, their Venmo friends list, the people that they take money from and send money to, out there in the public for anybody to take a look at, as well as some of them had some of their notes public as to who they were paying and why, including one payment made by Dan Katz, the chief of staff to Secretary of Treasury Besant, that was merely an eggplant emoji. That's right. Dan Katz paid somebody for something, and in thanking that person, sent the eggplant emoji. I don't think he was coming up with new vegetarian recipes for that payment, if you know what the eggplant emoji stands for. And payments that he was making to a man named Ivan Raiklin. Ivan Raiklin is a conspiracy theorist who posits that there is this massive deep state, and he writes up enemies lists and such. That's the level of security that we are dealing with here. That's the level of intelligence and due diligence from our national security staff, publicly paying people on Venmo for eggplants and having Russian phone numbers and email addresses. And as more and more of this comes out, I got to start thinking, what are the generals thinking? Every one of those generals and admirals in our United States military took an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. When the Secretary of Defense has Russian email and phone numbers, when the Secretary of Defense is giving out our timed battle plans in unsecure channels, at what point does our military recognize that these people in charge of them are the domestic enemies? I'm not one to be a fan of military coups, but at some point, if the ballot box doesn't work, we have to consider force. We take you now to the state of Maine, where school officials there will not comply with an order from Trump's administration to bar transgender athletes from participating in girls' sports. And first of all, just right off the bat of this story, I always have to note, whenever we're talking about the trans kids in sports, it's always the trans girls that's the problem. No, nobody's worried about girls transitioning to boys and competing in boys' sports. It's always the girls. Anyway, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services said that the Maine Department of Education, the Maine Principals Association, and that's not like the high school principals, that's kind of like their state high school athletics organization, is the Maine Principals Association. So the Maine Department of Education, the Maine Principals Association, and a particular high school, Greeley High School, are in violation of Title IX because of the participation of transgender athletes. Title IX being the federal law from the 70s that guaranteed equity in men's and women's sports. This, of course, comes after a public spat between the governor, Janet Mills, and Donald Trump on a conference call where she stood up to him and said that she would not comply with his order to ban transgender athletes and said, quote, "I'll see you in court." So, of course, that made Trump very angry, and he's got to direct his ire on the state of Maine. They were given 10 days to comply with this voluntary agreement from the Department of Health and Human Services. They said, all right, if you ban the trans athletes in 10 days, then we'll just let this all go by the wayside. And the Principals Association, the School District 51, which includes Greeley High School, said no. We will not comply. This all has to do with the controversy over a transgender girl who recently won the Class B girls pole vault competition. The Maine Principals Association said in a statement it is bound by law, including the Maine Human Rights Act, which our participation policy reflects. And that Maine Human Rights Act, that's Title 5, Chapter 337 in the state of Maine. I looked it up. And the policy is to prevent discrimination in employment, housing, education, extension of credit, or access to public accommodations on account of an individual's actual or perceived race, color, sex, sexual orientation or gender identity, physical or mental disability, religion, ancestry, or national origin. So they say they have to let the transgender athletes compete in order to comply with the Human Rights Act. Now, I think this is good news, generally speaking, because I don't think the federal government should be involved in high school sports. I think the federal government's got more important things to do. I think the individual states and the individual athletic associations can determine what the rules are for participation in their own sports. And if they decide that transgender girls are okay to participate, then that's up to them. There's all sorts of rules set for kids' sports. I recall a rule when I was playing the peewee football that had a weight rule, because you'd have, you know, these little kids, and then you'd have one behemoth kid come in there that's, you know, 100 pounds more than them, even though they're the same age. And it just, you know, wasn't very fair. So they'd have these different weight rules with respect. So, and that's where this transgender athlete controversy really comes down to, is why you think women and girls sports exist. So on one side, you have people that think that women's sports exist as sexual segregation. We have to have the women bodies over here and the men bodies over here. And because of that, they see the participation of transgender athletes as a person with the wrong body participating in that particular sport. The other point of view on this is that women and girls sports exist for inclusion. They exist for inclusion because women and girls would never be able to compete with men. The thought here being that the transgender athlete also can't compete with men because the transgender athlete has experienced puberty blockers and is on hormone therapy that makes them less able to compete with men that have, you know, full testosterone going. Now, I've expressed my opinion on this in the past, and the fact that I'm somewhat of a recovering transphobe, because some of these arguments that I hear make a little bit of sense to me. And the only thing that turns me off from these arguments are the people that are making them. Like, the worst people in the world make these arguments, but sometimes I can see their point. A state representative from Auburn, up in Maine, a Republican named Laurel Libby, posted a Facebook post that lamented the fact that the student, the transgender student who won the girls' Class B pole vault, tied for fifth place last year in the boys' Class B pole vault before transition. So I can see why that upsets people. I can see why people don't think that's fair. I can see why people think that, oh, you couldn't hack it as a boy. You were a fifth place boy, but now you're a first place girl. Because the transgender issue with respect to sports is one that's kind of akin to the performance enhancing drug issue with steroids. You know about that. We all think it's cheating if some guy goes and takes human growth hormone and steroids and becomes all super buff and able to outcompete the other men he's competing with because he's on these performance enhancing drugs. Well, to the person that doesn't want to see transgender kids competing in girls' sports, they see their transgenderness as sort of a performance-enhancing drug. In a sense, they see it as, oh, you got the benefit of a puberty and a body that the other competitors didn't get the benefit of. In a sense, we're asking people to agree that transition is a performance-decreasing drug. That the gender reassignment, the hormones being taken, the puberty blockers are a way to decrease the performance of a male body to bring it in to a competitive level with a female body. And I've heard the anti-trans spokespeople out there say there is no, that a female body is not a degraded male body. And it's hard for me to come up with responses to that. And I'm trying because, again, I know these people are on the wrong side of history. I know they're some of the worst people in the world. But it's tough. It's a tough issue to have to get behind and support unless you just completely blindly go to it through the inclusion angle and the discrimination angle. If you only see it as you're discriminating against someone because they're trans, well, then you can kind of be on that side. But the opposite point for that is that not everybody gets to do everything. You don't let Stevie Wonder fly a plane. That doesn't mean that we're discriminating against blind people. So how are we going to get through this? I'm on the side of inclusion and non-discrimination, but it's hard for me to square that with the fairness arguments, especially when we see cases like I've discussed before of Laurel Hubbard or Hannah Mounsey, some of these athletes who come out and transition late in life, way after puberty. It's really hard for me to make those cases. But also, I'm willing to admit, I'm no kinesiologist. Is that the word? Exercise doctor? Kinesiologist? Yeah, I'm no kinesiologist. I'm no sports expert. I'm no biologist. I don't know what's fair. But what I see with my eyes in some of these cases doesn't seem right, doesn't seem fair. So I'm going along to get along. I'm in support of trans rights, but I need better arguments. Years ago, lawmakers in the state of Wisconsin opened the floodgates to unlimited spending on elections, and since then, those chickens have definitely come home to roost. In the case of the Wisconsin Supreme Court race that's currently going on between Brad Schimmel, who's a former Republican Attorney General and a conservative judge now in Waukesha County, a conservative county in Wisconsin, versus Susan Crawford, who's a liberal judge in Dane County, one of the liberal strongholds in the state of Wisconsin. And the spending on this race is now set to top $100 million. $100 million in the state of Wisconsin for a Supreme Court election. Of course, the importance of this election is it would determine the ideological balance of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It's three conservatives, three liberals at this point, and whoever wins this race tips that court to either the conservative or the liberal side. And I think it's important as we talk about this to just kind of get our mind around how much $100 million in political spending is in the state of Wisconsin. They really only have one large media market there in Milwaukee. So ads don't cost that much in Wisconsin. I imagine the people there, every commercial break must be a pro or anti ad against one of the candidates involved here. The billionaires are behind a lot of this. The oligarchs are weighing in. Elon Musk on Brad Schimmel's side has donated tons of money, and George Soros on Susan Crawford's side has donated a ton of money. We have also J.B. Pritzker, the governor of Illinois, is involved in this. So lots of money flowing in. And Obama has endorsed Crawford. Trump has endorsed Schimmel. And there's a lot to determine what will happen here in the state of Wisconsin should this court flip. We have state legislative maps. In the past, the Republicans would draw the state legislative maps. They would gerrymander them, of course, to favor Republicans. The majority of the Supreme Court, as it was liberal recently, withdrew those and had fair maps drawn up. The Republicans also wanted to get or also got rid of drop boxes for absentee ballots. The liberals on the court got that put back on. So should Schimmel win in this case, they could reverse all of those changes and go back to having Republican drawn maps and not having drop boxes for their absentee ballots. Of course, the issue of abortion is also looming large in this case. Wisconsin has the right to abortion health care, and should Schimmel win, that right could be taken away in the wake of the Dobbs decision. There's also personal issues at stake here for the oligarchs. Elon Musk has a strong interest in his electric car company, because the state has determined, as has a law, that requires automobiles to be sold through independent dealerships. Well, Elon Musk doesn't like that. He wants Teslas only sold at Tesla dealerships, so he is suing the state. And should Schimmel win the seat in the Supreme Court, he could very well be victorious in that suit. With all these conflicts of interest, the local TV reporters asked the Republican candidate Schimmel if he would recuse himself if Elon Musk's Tesla case got to the high court. He wouldn't commit, saying only, "I'll do the same thing I do in every case. I will examine whether I can truly hear that case objectively." So the answer is no. He won't recuse himself in this case any more than our Supreme Court justices recuse themselves in cases involving, you know, their wife being involved in the January 6th uprising, you know, that kind of stuff. So the floodgates are open in the state of Wisconsin. We'll keep our eye on this race. Let's hope Susan Crawford can pull it out. All right, folks, I don't know what's going on this week. Earlier this week, I had to agree with Robert Fuckwit Kennedy that we should ban pharmaceutical TV ads. And today, folks, I'm sad to report, I have to agree with Missouri Senator Josh Hawley. Ugh, I know. Josh Hawley did something I agree with. Oh, my God. Talk about the stop clock being right twice a day. And in this case, it has to do with a win for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that capped our overdraft fees at banks at $5. That's right. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did something good for us and made it so that the banks couldn't keep gouging poor people who run out of money by fining them even more money. $5 cap for bounced check fees. Well, that is no more, because the Senate had voted 52 to 48 to undo that cap, to go ahead and allow the banks to charge whatever they want for non-sufficient funds fees. And it was Josh Hawley, the one Republican who bucked the rest of his party and voted with the Democrats against that. So this rule was projected to save an average of $225 a year for the average person. But now, to benefit the world's largest banks, Tim Scott, the Republican from South Carolina, introduced a resolution to repeal that rule, and there's a companion resolution in the House. So it's passed the Senate, and it's on its way to the House. Lauren Sanders, the associate director of the National Consumer Law Center, said, quote, "Senate Republicans just voted to block real relief for families hit with high prices to pad the profits of big banks like Chase and Wells Fargo and overdraft abusers like the Navy Federal Credit Union, which take billions in junk fees from families and service members just trying to make ends meet. It is shameful that Republicans are effectively writing bonus checks to executives at the nation's largest banks while ordinary people struggle with high prices and the increased costs of living," end quote. Yeah, they're set to make a bunch of money by overcharging us on these NSF fees. Wells Fargo and JP Morgan Chase each raked in about $1 billion in overdraft and NSF fees in 2024, four times as much as the next biggest bank. And the credit union data reveals that Navy Federal took in as much as the biggest banks did, $725 million from service members, veterans, and other customers, despite the fact that they have far fewer people banking with them than Wells Fargo or JP Morgan Chase. This overdraft rule was finalized in December, a $5 cap on most overdraft fees, down from the typical 35 $1,000 overdraft fees. The Bureau estimated that 23 million households pay overdraft fees that total up to $5 billion in year. $5 billion a year. And the other thing about this rule is it only applied to banks with over $10 billion in assets. The smaller banks and smaller credit unions could still have their larger NSF fees. So it's really just a giveaway to the fat cats here. Now, to their credit, Capital One, Citibank, and Ally have completely eliminated overdraft fees and continue to cover overdrafts. And this is just another way the big banks like to screw people over. Another one of the tricks they always like to do was to collect all of your debits first, then your deposits. So run all the debits first so that you end up negative and then start charging you NSF fees and then deposit the money that would have covered those checks in the first place. All sorts of tricks that these banks use to continue sucking money out of the American people. And the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, was helping the American people to fight back. That, of course, is why the Trump administration is moving to eliminate the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. In news from Brazil, five Supreme Court justices there ruled that the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, will have to stand trial for allegedly attempting to overturn his 2022 re-election loss and stage a violent coup. Holy crap! You can do that? You can hold ex-presidents to account if they try to violently overthrow the government? Whoa! Yeah, they've voted to move forward with a trial. There's an 884-page report that the Federal Investigative Police made public, and they agreed that this all warranted the trial. The prosecutors say that Bolsonaro participated in and directed a plot to overturn his re-election loss and even planned to poison his successor, the current president, Lula da Silva, and kill the vice president and a Supreme Court justice. Shades of hang Mike Pence and where's Nancy Pelosi. That same justice was the one overseeing this week's proceedings. Good move there. And said there's reasonable evidence that Bolsonaro knew, handled, and discussed plans for a coup. He, of course, denies any wrongdoing and says it's a witch hunt. It's all politically motivated. It's a witch hunt. Man, this sounds so familiar. Five justices were unanimous. They said seven close Bolsonaro allies should also stand trial on five counts: attempting to stage a coup, involvement in an armed criminal organization, attempted violent abolition of the democratic rule of law, damage characterized by violence, and a serious threat against the state's asset and deterioration of listed heritage. Wow, it's nice to see a country taking their democracy seriously and holding those who would threaten it to account, isn't it? Now, Bolsonaro was in office from 2019 through the end of 2022. After he lost the election, his supporters camped out in front of military institutions, demanding the military to overturn the results. Bolsonaro fled to the United States before the person who won took office, and after Inauguration Day, his supporters ransacked the government buildings. More than 1,400 of them were arrested. Wow. It just, talk about history rhyming. I mean, this sounds exactly like what happened in our country. Bolsonaro had already been banned from running for office until 2030. He was barred by Brazil's electoral courts for abuse of power after he made unfounded claims about the voting system. The voting system is rigged. It's all rigged. It's all the deep state. This is just MAGA in Portuguese. My God. So also Bolsonaro is in trouble for falsifying vaccination records. He apparently falsified COVID-19 vaccine cards so that he and others who weren't vaccinated could get into the United States and get around the mandatory immunization requirements that were in place at the time. So a COVID denier as well. This guy is the South American Trump. And notice how he was banned for running for office until 2030. Boy, wouldn't that have been nice? If only we had put something in our Constitution that said that people who foment an insurrection are ineligible for office. That might have been a good... Oh, what's that? Oh, we have that in our Constitution. The Supreme Court just said it doesn't count. Ah, that's right. Man, this is just so glaring when you have countries like South Korea, like Brazil, where these coups happen, and immediately, there are moves to restore justice. The fact that Joe Biden and Merrick Garland on January 20th, 2021, didn't immediately move to arrest Donald Trump shows you how wedded the Democratic Party is to norms and institutions. Why? We can't go arrest an ex-president. Think of the decorum. I'm telling you, the reason Joe Biden lost his re-election was because we voted for him to end MAGA. We wanted to see an end to the destructive politics of the MAGA movement. And then Merrick Garland refused to prosecute, dragged his feet. We allowed all of the court cases to get delayed and justice to be denied, except for in New York State, where Trump was convicted of 34 counts of fraud. And yet we allowed him to run for office. And he went and won, and now is in the process of dismantling our democracy bit by bit, agency by agency, law by law, rule by rule. Let's hope that we can all learn something from the people of Brazil. Let's hope that Jair Bolsonaro faces these charges and is convicted and imprisoned for many, many decades. And maybe someday, maybe if we're able to have free and fair elections and restore democratic power in Washington, D.C., maybe by 2030, we could be holding Trump to trial as well. Well, today we got a special guest joining us for our usual Boycott Idaho segment, someone who can tell us a little bit more about what's going on the ground, a person very near and dear to my heart. I've known her for years and years. She's my mentee. She's the Liz Lemon to my Jack Donaghy. It's Sarah Frank joining us on the phone. Sarah, how you doing?
I'm great, Russ. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. So let's tell folks a little bit. I've known you for so long working on various campaigns in Idaho for adoption of a medical marijuana initiative. I know you've done a lot of work with CPS. I'm not exactly sure what all groups you're in charge of or what your titles are at this point. So why don't you just tell our audience who the hell you are?
Well, I am Sarah, and I am an Idaho activist. I think that's about the biggest label. We all wear so many hats when it comes to these things, and I'd wear a million more if I had more time.
Yeah,
but cannabis and CPS are both my passions, so, and they tend to go hand in hand.
Yeah, there's,
especially in Idaho.
there's some crossover there, I understand. With respect to CPS, let's start there, because folks may know that stands, there's different acronyms for it in different states, and for Idaho, it's CPS, which means Child Protective Services. Other places, it's like Department of Children and Families. They all have different names everywhere you go. But in your work with CPS, it's often overlapped with marijuana, because of course, Idaho is a state where marijuana is still a criminal offense, now with a brand new $300 misdemeanor mandatory fine. And how does that intersect, and how is that affecting parents out there with respect to the custody of their kids?
Well, that is an issue everywhere, not just in Idaho, but legal states as well. I work with a lot of families all over the place. Idaho, it's, you know, still in their arsenal of ways to remove babies at hospitals. I'm still getting phone calls, you know, from mom who just had baby and baby tested positive. So here's CPS trying to do a safety plan. And It's just ongoing, and I think it's going to be ongoing for a while, even in our legal states.
So even in a place like Oregon, where a person could be, you know, on the medical marijuana program and be given, you know, a doctor has recommended that they use cannabis, and I imagine for pregnant moms, you know, there could be issues with severe nausea that might be treated with a little bit of THC here and there. Is that what's happening is in these legal states as well, that even though it's legal and a doctor may have recommended it, they could lose their kid over it?
Yes, or they will use them to keep them out of the home even after parents have completed all of the requirements from CPS. I've dealt with a few cases like that. One, you know, dear to my heart, Miss Lily Fisher, that was in 2012, 2013, right as Washington legalized. And we had to fight over her father being a medical marijuana patient. And then 10 years later, almost in 2020, I was over in Kitsap County, Washington, fighting for a mom who was using as a medical patient, and they had completed all of their stuff and they were getting ready to adopt out their children just because they were medical marijuana patients. And yeah, so it's an ongoing issue and one we're going to be fighting even after we get legalization across the country.
What about someone out there who's skeptical would think, you know, we don't want kids to be around drugs. And if the parents there are using marijuana, even for medical purposes, the kid could get into it. Or there might be transfer of THC through breast milk. Or what do you say to those folks to try to quell their fears or to address the real data behind that?
Oh, I always point to Melanie Dreyer from the university. She's the dean of nursing at the University of Chicago, Illinois. And she is known for the largest ever done study on pregnancy use or cannabis use during pregnancy. And she did a very long study down in Jamaica and followed the children as they went through the years and found actually that they were meeting milestones faster. So cannabis use during pregnancy is, you know, something that I believe is going to be a more common thing in the future because of how nutritious it is, how beneficial it is. And even Dr. Dreyer, I believe she quoted how surprised she was at how robust cannabis, or how cannabis had such a robust impact on these newborns, helping them be healthier. And so I always point to that. And then, of course, we point to, you know, women already naturally make cannabinoids in breast milk. But then at the same time, you know, we point to if doctors are okay prescribing pregnant women opiates, then why is cannabis worse than that? You know, cannabis is safer. Cannabis is non-toxic. Preaching to the choir here.
No, people need to hear this. I wonder also, you know, with your broad experience working with these CPS cases, what you might tell us outside of marijuana cases, what kind of shocking CPS cases might we have not heard about that don't get covered in the news?
One of the most common things that we find is these medical kidnappings where they have child abuse specialists who are employed by the hospitals. And they come in and they determine that a child has been abused without even ever seeing that child. The hope that I see on the horizon is that these stories, just like with cannabis, are finally starting to reach the surface. So if you look on Netflix, there is a story, you know, there's so many different angles of the corruption found in CPS that we could go on for hours. But one of them is the failure of the department to protect abused children while they're going after children who aren't abused, like from marijuana patients. And for instance, there's the Trials of Gabriel Fernandez, which is on Netflix, and it is that failure to protect an abused child. And then there's also on Netflix is Take Care of Maya, which is just a devastating, heartbreaking story out of Florida. Once again, about these medical kidnappings where they go in and they, the one with Take Care of Maya had to do with a ketamine treatment. The parents had her on a ketamine treatment with a different doctor and they took her into the hospital to try to get, you know, some relief for her again after she had already done all these treatments. And they took her away. This teenage girl took her away from her parents and said, they're just drugging her with ketamine, even though it's what was truly helping her. And it just, it goes on so much that The family ended up winning a $1 million lawsuit against the hospital for the medical kidnapping.
Wow.
So, as I said, that, you know, I'm seeing it to start coming out. You know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when I first started dealing with the CPS cases, it wasn't public knowledge. But now it is quickly becoming public knowledge, especially the medical kidnapping. And that is where, you know, cannabis use falls under when it comes to CPS. Mm-hmm. They are using cannabis, medical use of cannabis, to kidnap these children.
You know, another aspect of this that I've seen come across a few times is a case where, and I'll just speak in general terms here, a case where they'll find a kid is being neglected or being brought up in a situation where there's not enough support for the kid. Perhaps the folks have lost their job, they're homeless, they're living in a car, whatever, and the CPS will say, well, you're not providing enough of a background, you're not providing enough to support these kids, so they'll take the kid and put them with foster family and then give that foster family money to support the kid. It's like, well, why exactly. Didn't you just give the money to the parents and, in the first place,
you know? that and it's like $400 or $500 a month for each of these children that the foster parents receive, and the state receives so much more than that monthly for them. But, you know, it would have been very helpful to have $400 or $500 extra every month to take care of my kid. And those families, you're absolutely right. They might not be homeless. They might have more resources if the state actually helped them instead of making money off of them being out of their home, which is what's happening.
Yeah, that's just so shocking and absurd. I'm glad you're doing work on that and bringing people's awareness to these things. Let's shift gears a bit and talk a little bit about Idaho, since this is the Idaho segment. I made a hint about some of the new laws that have come across the transom there, the new $300 mandatory minimum marijuana fine. What else is going on in the state of Idaho that people need to be aware of?
Oh, it is a full-blown war. We are at war in Idaho now. The Idaho legislature has declared war on all cannabis consumers in Idaho, from the $300 minimum mandatory fine to they have now proposed a new amendment to the state constitution that will prevent anybody from ever bringing any kind of citizen initiative to legalize any kind of drug that is currently illegal, whether that be cannabis for medical use or recreation. But also like psilocybin, you know, people, the microdosing that they're finding that really helped their veterans with PTSD, that could never be a thing unless the legislature passes it with a 2/3 majority.
Well,
if this amendment passes, and luckily it goes to the people first. And so the people have something to vote on in Idaho now for November 2026 to vote no. Because it doesn't matter whether or not you support legalization of cannabis in Idaho or just medical or not at all. This is bad for both sides. It is them asking the voters to take away their own voice.
Yeah.
By preventing them from ever voting on it. So say right now we have a very anti-marijuana legislature, and a lot of people might be okay with that, you know, because they don't support cannabis. But 10 years from now, a different legislature could pass it without their vote. Anyway, you know, it's bad for both sides.
Yeah. And it strikes me as, you know, not very well thought through, because especially that part about needing the 2/3 majority to then set future laws. This is not only the legislature trying to ask the people to take a power away from themselves. They're asking to take power away from their own legislature as well, because doesn't every other law in Idaho only have to be passed by a majority?
Right. So you could get a 65% majority and still lose because you need a 66%.
That's just insane. And only on this one particular subject, and a subject that changes pretty rapidly. I mean, how fast we went from thinking, you know, marijuana was the demon dangerous drug to it being medical, and the things that we're learning about the benefits of psilocybin. What's the next medical beneficial breakthrough that's going to happen that we then have to try to get past these old rural legislators and get 2/3 of them on board? We can't even get 2/3 of them on board with with what's going on right now. What can you pass with a 2/3 majority anymore?
What comes to mind that would be especially detrimental to Idaho is ibogaine, especially with our fentanyl and opiate you know, crisis. It's we need to be able to explore other options to combat these things. And Ibogaine is one that is, you know, it's a hallucinogen and it's illegal, and we would never be able to legalize that either with a ballot initiative if this passes. And without the legislature on our side for, well, anything.
Yeah.
You know, that's a common thing for Idaho right now, is that even though the public doesn't support most of what they're passing, they're still passing it. And they're not just attacking cannabis or drugs or legalization. I mean, they've gone after head shops now, so they're attacking glass, they're attacking CBD, but they're also attacking the initiative process in general. They have that 35 out of 35 legislative district bill again, which, you know, we've argued about and fought about for quite a few years now.
Yeah, for people that don't know, in Idaho, to try to get something on the ballot as a citizen initiative, you have to get not just 6% of the voters statewide, you got to get 6% from each of 18 of 35, that is a majority, of the legislative districts in the state of Idaho. So you got to spread it out a bit. And with that, what, they've only had, I guess the Medicaid expansion is the only thing that's even gotten on the ballot since then, is that right?
That is correct. And they're working on rescinding that.
Oh, yeah. I got to repeal that as well. So, they want to make it so that you have 35 out of 35 districts. You have to get a 6% buy-in from every single district. This was already declared unconstitutional by the Idaho Supreme Court just, what, 4 or 5 years ago?
Yeah, they think we forget stuff. And then on top of that, they put a new bill in, and I don't think it made it very far this time, but it might, you know, they tend to refile next year. And this one was to, even if we got a citizens initiative onto the ballot and we got a majority vote on it by the people, by the voters in the election, the governor could then veto that. And
yeah,
they're just attacking all liberties in Idaho. It doesn't matter if you're a cannabis consumer or not.
And just the threat of a veto, I mean, you could be starting your signature gathering campaign, and if the governor said, oh no, I will veto this if it makes the ballot, well, there goes your campaign. You know, who's going to want to sign? You know, what's the point of even getting involved at that point?
And another, all that money towards it.
Yeah, and here's the other maddening thing about that, is that we're talking about statutory initiatives. These are the citizens just creating a law, which then the legislature can come in and change that law. It happened out here in Oregon when we passed our Measure 91. We had a $35 an ounce tax, and they changed it to a percent tax. We had it legal pot shops in every county. They changed it so the eastern counties could opt out, right? So they can already monkey with whatever we pass as it is. That's not enough. They can have veto power. Insane. Yeah. Insane. All right. So another topic I wanted to talk to you about, since you've actually had children, not, and I have not, you raised kids and raised kid in the state of Idaho and had to send them to school. So I wanted to get your take on what's going on with the Everyone is Welcome poster and the brouhaha going on there in Idaho. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I agree. Everyone is welcome in Idaho, but a lot of people don't agree with that. And I think what's happening is it's a culture war, you know, and then things like teachers are getting caught up in the middle of it. You know, kids are supposed to be welcome everywhere. I also saw another thing that people were very upset that there was rainbows in the classrooms. And it's like, rainbows are everywhere in elementary school. That is what you do. You're learning the colors of the rainbow.
So yeah, just not in order. Just not in order. You got to mix them up. So red, purple, just, yellow, blue, green.
People are just, it's a culture thing. It's a culture war. And Idaho is extremely conservative, so a lot of people cling to that and then justify their behavior with that, even though it's not morally acceptable behavior for anyone.
Yeah, it really seems like it's backfired on that school district. I've been reading reports of the 20,000 t-shirts sold and you know, international news covering this stuff. So I think it's a real backfire on them.
Yes, for sure.
Hey, let's wind things up talking about your activism, because I know you've been involved with medical campaigns in the past, and you've been director of the Boise Hemp Fest. So what's happening on the activism front for you?
Oh, well, we've got all sorts of stuff. Lots of irons in the fire, and they're all melding together. It's before they even started attacking us with this legislature, we began a new campaign. We're resurrecting the Educate and Legalize Idaho tour, which happened back in 2020 when we were doing the initiative through the Idaho Cannabis Coalition. And COVID shut that down along with that petition. So
yeah,
thought it was time to resurrect that. One thing I realized this year will be 20 years of me being an activist.
Wow, congrats.
Thanks. I think the only other thing I've done with my life for 20 years is raise children.
So, yeah.
You know, I'm pretty proud of both of those things, and they go hand in hand for sure. But to celebrate, I, you know, kind of wanted to resurrect this tour. And what we've realized is it, you know, as many petitions as we bring to the table, if people don't know the benefits of cannabis or know anything about it and still think it's a gateway drug, still think it kills brain cells, even though it's a neuroprotectant, still think it causes homelessness and drug addiction. And, you know, so education is key. You know, we need to educate our citizens. And not just those who use cannabis. And so our next year, we're doing this Educate and Legalize Idaho tour. It will go from May 1st to May 1st, May 1st, 2025 to 2026. It begins with Boise Hemp Fest number 9 on May 10th this year. And then it will end with a 2-day event in April 2026, right around the 420 weekend. And our goal is to create a coalition, again, this time of people all across the state to help bring education, awareness, and discussion about cannabis to our local Idaho communities. And we hope by doing this, you know, this isn't going to be something that, oh, when the petition's done, we're done. It is an ongoing, let's build our network, our coalition, boots on the ground, do it the way our great-grandparents did, and go talk to our neighbors. Type of effort and get this conversation going. As part of that tour, we will be doing 12 in-person educational events, like I said, starting with HempFest, ending with HempFest, but 10 more in between in the top 10 populated cities in Idaho. And then in addition to that, we are doing 12 virtual cannabis town halls through Zoom that we hope we will invite everybody to, positive or pro and con, pro and anti prohibitionists. Everyone's welcome to the table as usual. Not sure if they'll accept the invitation. They haven't so far in the last 10 years. So we'll see what happens. You know, ever since that first one at BSU, I believe, you know, you debated 3 empty chairs.
I remember it well. And I remember the Boise police showing up at my motel door that night as well. Right. It is tough being an activist in a red state, I tell you. And I salute you for continuing to do this. I know it takes a lot of effort and a lot of resources. If there's any of my listeners out there that want to help out, how can they get in touch with you to support the tour and to support your activism?
LegalizeIdaho.com. And one thing I've noticed is Google and Facebook and everybody is, you know, really shadow banning us on a lot of things when it comes to just Googling our name. Mm. So make sure you find us, LegalizeIdaho.com, hashtag LegalizeIdaho, Google those terms and you'll most likely find us. But then also BoiseHempFest.org, of course. And anybody who wants to reach out directly, we are looking for everybody to join us. We want all eyes on Idaho to help, you know, spread awareness about what's going on. We are literally, you know, people always say, oh, Idaho's going to be the last state. We already are.
We are pretty much
literally the last state with any kind of reform. We are the only state in the country whose governor vetoed the CBD for epileptic children bill.
Yeah.
We're the only state in the country who arrested truck drivers after the farm bill. And now we are, I believe, the only state in the country that has a mandatory minimum for simple marijuana possession.
I believe you're absolutely right. And I'll add to that stack, the only state that I'm aware of whose legislature proactively said that marijuana shall never be legal.
Right.
Yeah, the 20
numerous times.
Yeah, that 2013 I think was the first resolution they did on that. I wanted to bring this up earlier when we were talking about the medical or their attempts to bring down initiatives. That's kind of one of the things that's funny to me is they run in such fear of there being a medical initiative that's going to be brought in by these big money out of state drug legalizer George Soros interests, and I'm like, where the hell are they?
right. Send them my way, please.
Really?
In fact, I heard that the other day. Somebody said something about, oh, the marijuana advocates are at it again, and with their big marijuana money behind them. And it's like, okay, fine. You always say we have big marijuana money behind us. So I am putting a challenge and call to action to the world. Get that marijuana money behind Idaho.
Yeah.
Let's legalize Idaho. They're saying you're already doing it. Let's do it.
Yeah, might as well.
Send them my way. My email is director@legalizeidaho.com. That is how you can find me.
Well, leave it at that. Send the big checks to director@legalizeidaho.com. Sarah Frank, thank you again. Happy 20th anniversary of activism, and good luck to all you're doing out there.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Rob.
As we continue to marvel at the incompetency of this WikiLeaks report of the principles of our national security apparatus, openly discussing war plans on an unsecured app on unsecured phones in the presence of a reporter they did not even know was there, it would be a good time to go back and try to figure out how in the world did these people get confirmed? A lot of these people faced confirmation hearings in the United States Senate, and there were a number of Democrats who approved of these people. Democrats who gave their thumbs up to someone nominated by an insurrectionist. And it's been my point that at the beginning of this term, the Democrats should have been 100% in opposition to anything proposed by this administration. Anything. They want to rename a post office? Oppose it. They want to dedicate a National Puppies Day? Oppose it. This is an illegitimate administration. An unconstitutional administration. The third section of the 14th Amendment is clear that Donald Trump should not be in the Oval Office. And the people that he would nominate are the nominees of an insurrectionist, of a traitor. We shouldn't approve their nominees any more than we'd approve Jefferson Davis's nominees. But the Democrats did, again, so wed to the idea of bipartisanship and comity that they went and gave their stamp of approval. And I'm getting this breakdown from the always excellent activist Charlotte Clymer out on Blue Sky. First of all, let's start with the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio, who was on the signal to call, our Secretary of State, who didn't see anything wrong with discussing classified war plans on an unsecured channel, our Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, was approved by every Democratic senator. He was approved 99-0. Every Democrat in the Senate said, yeah, sure, Marco, he'd be great for Secretary of State. Marco Rubio, the guy who right now has gone off after the visas of foreign students. We told you the story of Ozturk, the woman who was from Tufts University, who's abducted by plainclothes officers. Her visa revoked because, according to Rubio, if you come into this country and cause a ruckus, we're going to get rid of you. A ruckus. A ruckus. Her ruckus was writing an op-ed in the student newspaper about Tufts University and the response to the genocide ongoing in Palestine at the hands of the Israelis. Now, whether or not you agree with that, whether or not you think Israel's committing a genocide, whether you think she's supporting Hamas, which she's not, she never even mentions Hamas, but in the Republican worldview, if you think Palestinians are human beings who shouldn't be indiscriminately bombed into non-existence, you support terrorism. Shades of the era after 9/11. Boy, you can't say anything against the war on terror or else you support terrorists. Marco Rubio, gloating about taking the visas of over 300 students merely for expressing their point of view. So the First Amendment apparently doesn't apply to people who aren't citizens in this country. The First Amendment no longer applies. You no longer have the right to petition your government for a redress of grievances, peaceably assemble, or exercise your free speech, or we'll take your visa away, have plainclothes Gestapo abduct you in the middle of the street, disappear you to somewhere in Louisiana incommunicado, and kick you out of the country. The guy behind that was approved by every Democratic senator. How about Kristi Noem, the secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, head of the SS, if you will? Kristi Noem, who before being confirmed was already known to be someone who murders dogs, already known to have committed canicide, Kristi Noem was approved by Fetterman, Hassan, Kane, Kim, Peters, Shaheen, and Slotkin. Seven Democrats thought that Kristi Noem would be okay. The woman cosplaying as Lara Croft with a $60,000 Rolex watch standing in front of what looks like Auschwitz. Men stacked to the ceiling behind bars. Some of those in there without any due process. All of them in there without any due process. Some of them not gang members. Some of them gay hairdressers. Some of them brothers of autistic kids. Some of them mere soccer fans. The woman committing these atrocities in our name, the woman putting people into concentration camps without due process, was approved by seven Democratic senators. CIA Director John Ratcliffe, who was lying to Congress in the Signal investigation,
I don't recall any war plans. I don't recall any details about planes. I don't recall any details about missiles.
Was approved by 20 Democratic senators. Bennett, Booker, Coons, Durbin, Gallego, Gillibrand, Hassan, Hickenlooper, Kane, Kelly, Klobuchar, Murray, Peters, Reid, Shaheen, Slotkin, Stabenow, Holland, Warner, and Whitehouse. All approved this liar to head our CIA. Pam Bondi, the attorney general, the one they had to get when Matt Gaetz couldn't get confirmed. Pam Bondi, the former Florida attorney general, who basically this week said it's okay for Trump to bully everybody. Pam Bondi, the one who is just this week saying, oh, it's okay that they were all talking on Signal. It's okay. It's safe. Signal is safe communication. There's no way foreigners can hack it. That Pam Bondi. Pam Bondi, that attorney general, was supported by John Fetterman. John Fetterman. Oh, boy. So, how many of these Democratic senators supported the most Trump cabinet picks? Well, we've got a five-way tie. John Fetterman, Ruben Gallego, Maggie Hassan, John Hickenlooper, and Jean Shaheen voted for 10 of Trump's cabinet nominees. Again, senators, if you have an insurrectionist, a fraud, a pedophile, a person as odious as Donald Trump presenting to you people to approve, people who, in his judgment, would be good for the job, and you agree with them, there's something seriously wrong. And it starts at the top with Chuck Schumer and his failure to lead the Senate Democrats as a real opposition party. to stand as a roadblock in the way of everything attempted by this Trump maladministration. So once again, let's call to Chuck Schumer. It's time for new leadership in the Democratic Party. It's time for more young people to run for office. It's time to primary every Democratic incumbent, or at least the ones born before Kennedy's assassination in 1963. Well, that's everything I have for you this week. I want to thank you all for listening to the podcast, my little labor of love, my little therapy hobby. So glad to have you here. And if you want to pass the podcast on to others to listen to, I would appreciate that. The Radical Russ Show is produced, directed, researched, written, recited, posted, and catered by me, Radical Russ Belville, and governed by Creative Commons share-alike licensing. My main theme is We Love the Herb by Herbal Nation, and interstitial music is by freestockmusic.com and VTEMO, courtesy of freetouse.com/music. Okay, so those of you who are listening to these end credits, quick little movie recommendation. Check out the 2001 movie Heartbreakers. It stars Jennifer Love Hewitt and Sigourney Weaver. Got an amazing cast, chock full of great people. It's a fun little show. You can kind of watch it while you're scrolling. It doesn't take a lot of effort. But the main reason I watched it is because Gene Hackman's in it. And Gene Hackman has a great performance, as usual. Check it out. Heartbreakers from 2001. It's on the Roku channel right now. Probably find it on some other streaming outlets. Oh, you can contact me by email at radicalrus@gmail.com. Call my message line at 877-RUSS-420. That's 877-877-420. And reach me on social media on Blue Sky as radicalrus.com and nowhere else. You can support this podcast financially by donating to Radical Russ on Venmo, Rad Russ on Cash App, or via PayPal on my website at radicalrus.com. But if you're one of our national security principles, please turn off the public Venmo part when you donate to me. I think Trump would be a little angry. Get this podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, my website, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. And until next time, take care of each other.
You plant it, you grow it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it.